From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the best comedic actors on television, David Hyde Pierce of Frasier. He's won two Emmys for his role as Frasier's younger brother, Niles, and he's one of the lead voices in the new Disney animated feature, A Bug's Life. Also, screenwriter and director Todd Haynes discusses his new film, Velvet Goldmine, set in the glam rock era of the early 70s, when it became popular for male rock stars to create androgynous alter egos decked out in feathers and glitter. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Sheryl Crow's new CD, The Globe Sessions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Frasier is a great example of a sitcom at its funniest with acting at its best. My guest, David Hyde Pierce, has received two Emmys, a Golden Globe, a Screen Actors Guild Award, and four American Comedy Awards for his portrayal of Niles, Frasier's younger brother. Both brothers are psychiatrists. Frasier, played by Kelsey Grammer, hosts a call-in radio show, although he's out of work at the moment because his station changed formats. Niles' psychological insights didn't save him from one of the worst marriages and longest divorces in history. The brothers are snobbish, effete, egotistical, and insecure. Although they have a close relationship, they're very competitive and suspicious of each other. Here's Niles calling on Frasier.
Hello, I know I'm a bit early. I was hoping we might get a bite to eat before the theater.
Actually, Niles,
it'll be on me, of course, as a thank you for getting those replacement tickets.
Just about the tickets.
I know, I owe you money, and my gratitude, and if I keep talking, you won't be able to tell me that you weren't able to get the tickets.
Just haven't been able to get them yet.
Oh, I knew you wouldn't get them!
Niles, please!
Oh, and now it's too late, it's 6 o'clock.
Please, just calm down. I've made a few well-placed calls. I haven't heard back from a couple of people. Someone will call.
Well, someone better call, because everyone who's anyone is seeing this play. And you know who you are if you're not anyone? You're no one. And I've been someone much too long to start being no one now.
The character of Frasier originated on the show Cheers. I asked David Hyde Pierce if when he was cast in the show Frasier, he studied episodes of Cheers to get a sense of the family traits and mannerisms.
Yes, in fact, that's specifically what I did. I watched a lot of old episodes of Cheers to get the physical behavior, because I felt like when I looked at my own family, first of all, I look more like Kelsey than I look like any other member of my real family. So physical resemblance isn't necessarily the key, but what does happen is people have the same kind of speech patterns and the same physical mannerisms. We've all had the experience of looking in the mirror and being horrified to realize we were acting exactly like our mom or our dad. And that kind of stuff, I thought, was what would let people know that we were really brothers. If we moved in the same way, if we had the same tilt of the head when we spoke, if we hit words and voiced words in a similar way.
I know Kelsey Grammer's a big admirer of Jack Benny, and you can kind of see that in some of his gestures. Did you go back to Jack Benny also to kind of better get to what Kelsey Grammer would be like and register that family trait?
I didn't. That's something else that Kelsey does, which was a whole new kind of acting for me, which is, I don't know if you know the term sampling, which they can do with pieces of sound technology. You can sample the playing of an instrument with a synthesizer. And Kelsey can almost sample famous actors, like someone who does impressions, except what he does is he will incorporate Jack Benny or Betty Davis or James Mason or whoever into the line that he's saying as Frasier, so that it is simultaneously echoes the famous person, but it's really still Frasier speaking. And that gives him this enormous range. I even did a scene where he did Daffy Duck in a perfectly believable way.
Frasier, in a way, the show is a contrast in two types of masculinity. You know, the father who's the retired cop and loves sports and his old easy chair and meat and potatoes. And Frasier and Niles, who, are impeccably dressed and they're connoisseurs of wine and food and furniture. And in a way, they're almost like, they almost embody certain of the traits that are stereotyped as gay traits. Including some of their gestures. And I'm wondering if that's something that's ever discussed on the set or the show.
We don't ever discuss it on the show, although we did address it, actually, in an early episode. There's kind of a famous episode of from the first season called The Matchmaker, where a new station manager took over Frasier's radio station, and the guy was gay, but Frasier didn't know it. And Frasier
tried.
That's
a very funny episode. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, yeah. Well, it was a great episode. Joe Keenan wrote it, one of our very good writers, and there was a whole mix-up where Frasier thought he was setting up this guy to date Daphne, and the guy thought it was a setup for him to date Frasier. And near the end of it, because of a variety of confusing circumstances, this guy also thinks that Frasier's dad is gay. And finally, it all gets straightened out at the end. And he says, so your dad's not gay? And he says, no, dad's not gay. And then the guy says, but Niles, come on. And it was our way of addressing, because a lot of people have talked about the fact, especially with Frasier and Niles and a lot of stuff that they do together, that, as you said, it's a sort of a stereotypical gay relationship, and that they like to dress well, they like fine wine and opera and all that stuff. But there's one critical part of gay relationships which they're not really into, and that seems to me to be the dividing line, and that's more of the anatomical area, which is they both love women. And so I think that the rest of it, as you said, it really is a stereotype if it necessitates them being gay because they like those things. There's a certain sort of, as you describe different kinds of masculinity, there's a very English, as opposed to English peasant, but a kind of an upper-class English feeling about them. Also a sort of Southern gentleman feeling, that it's a more of a, I guess you could say, a feline masculinity, as opposed to dad or bulldog, who's the sportscaster on the show, who's more of a, you know, eating hot dogs and beans and slapping people around kind of guy.
Right. Now, the writing is so funny on the show. Can you think of an example of lines that you particularly liked that kind of exemplify to you the quality of the writing?
Yes. The one that always pops into my head is there was a scene where the unseen Maris were having a party at Frasier's apartment, and no one can find her, and I explained that she fell asleep, and she's under all the coats on the bed. And my line is that she exhausts easily under the pressure to be interesting. And what I love about that line is, if you look at the actual wording of it, it's a little bit wordy. It's a little bit highfalutin. She exhausts easily under the... But what makes it funny is the description of this personality, because in some way we've all been there. We've all been at parties and had to put on that face, and we know how you go home, and it's supposed to have been a party, and you're wiped out from the effort. And she just takes it to the nth degree. So it's a combination of a skillful use of language, but also a skillful just depiction of character. And I think most of the humor of the show, as it should, comes out of situations like that, as opposed to jokes.
Because there's... a kind of almost ornate style of speaking that Niles has. I'm sure his cadences are a little bit different than yours. Was it hard to get into that rhythm?
It's a good question. It wasn't difficult because it's well written. It's easy to pick up on the speech pattern. And again, because I was sort of modeling it after the way Kels speaks as Frasier, mm-hmm. I had a role model there. One of the things that we are always playing with, and one of the differences between the writers who write for our show and sometimes when people send in scripts that they've written in hoping to get hired for the show, is that the writers understand that there's a subtle difference between someone who uses language in a certain way and just simply writing a lot of big words because that somehow seems to be what the characters are all about. A lot of times we'll find that you have to tone Niles' language down because in a given situation, a very emotional situation, say, or for example, he might not fall into those elevated speech patterns that he would have when he's more relaxed and he's talking about the wine club. And I think that's also what keeps him real.
Would you compare your voice and style of speaking with Niles?
Well, it's hard. You know why? Because as soon as I start getting analytical and talking about the show and being philosophical about it, then I automatically almost become become him. Let's see. There's a certain other placement in the voice that he speaks mm-hmm. almost in a little higher pitch than I do. And the pronunciation of the words is just a little bit archer and a little bit more enunciated and, what's the word? That sort of thing. And there's little inflections like that that creep in. Sometimes I'll be like somewhere else in the country and people will say, oh, you don't have an English accent, thinking that I do have an English accent because of whatever it is I'm doing as the character. It's sort of, it reads that way.
Yeah, it's arch and clipped.
Yeah. And a little bit operatic at times. He gets
yes.
extremely agitated over not very important things. We just had he was just invited to a party where he brought a bottle of 81 Chateau Haute-Brion, and he wasn't there 2 minutes before he heard a pop, looked up, and saw it being decanted into a punch bowl of sangria, canned fruit, and erotic ice cubes. So it is. It's sort of a higher range, I think, when he gets excited about
it. It must be interesting to play a character for so long that you have two, you know, different styles of speech that you know so well, your own and your character's.
Well, and in fact, I think I've played him so long that when you asked me the question about what was the difference between my speech and Niall's, I got extremely nervous because I suddenly thought, you know, I'm not sure there is one anymore. I think that the gap has narrowed over the last 6 years.
Now, I know you shoot in front of a live audience, which means that there's real laughter that you have to deal with, which mm-hmm. will affect the timing. You can't talk over the high point of a laugh. The trick is, I think, if the audience is laughing, and it's a fairly extended laugh, the camera doesn't pan to the audience. It's still on you. So mm-hmm. you have to be doing something while you're not speaking during the laughter.
Yes. Well, we've all become masters of sort of idle fiddling and, you know, stirring coffee during long laughs, or you can check your shoelaces and see if they're tied. What it is, it's just fun. It's you try to find behavior that the character would actually be doing in the moment, but what you're also doing is you're feeding the laughter because it just makes people laugh more when they see you riding that wave of laughter, however you choose to ride it out. If Kels and I are in the scene together, then we can do a good 10 minutes of just making faces at each other until eventually we both laugh and then it's over.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Hyde Pierce, and he's the star of Frasier. He plays Niles, Frasier's brother. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Hyde Pierce, and he plays Niles on the series Frasier. Now, the story goes that, you know, no one knew that Frasier had a brother when Frasier was a character on Cheers. I don't think Frasier knew he had a brother. And then when he was given the new series, he still wasn't supposed to have a brother, but the story goes that the creators of the show were given a picture of you, saw this incredible facial similarity, then watched tapes of you, loved your performance, and thought, well, let's write him in as the brother. Did you see the similarity when you looked at Kelsey Grammer?
My mom, when I first came out to L.A., which is about 6 or 7 years ago, said to me, now you look like Kelsey Grammer. Maybe you could be on his show. And that was back on Cheers.
And, really?
Yeah, and no one else thought that at the time. But then, totally without me having anything to do with it, this casting director, Sheila Guthrie, who was working with Jeff Greenberg, the main casting director for Frasier, she brought them my photo. And they didn't know who I was, like most people. And like you said, she also brought them some tapes from the only other TV show I'd ever done, only other sitcom, which was called The Powers That Be. And it was a Norman Lear political satire where John Forsythe played a senator. I played a suicidal congressman. And they looked at those tapes, and based on those, they actually met with me. And this is the humiliating part, because they met with me for about half an hour, and then they went away and wrote Niles. So I don't know what that says about me, but it's that's the way it fell out.
Right. So it's funny because although I see certain similarities between you and Kelsey Grammer, you're a much more kind of refined version of that, you know, smaller and, you know, more elegant.
Refined is nice. I like refined. You know what? If you see pictures of him, I saw a shot of him. He was just out of college. It was taken in New York. And or also, he was on a soap opera back then when he was still going to Juilliard. And he looks... It's me. It isn't even he looks like me. It's me. Hmm. And so I think... We, depending on the year of the show, we look more or less alike each other. But there's definitely a familial resemblance kind of thing.
David Hyde Pierce is my guest, and he plays Niles on Frasier. I'd like to run through some of the movies that you've been in, and maybe you could just say a few words about your part in each one and what it was like for you. Let's start with your movie premiere debut, Bright Lights, Big City.
Yes, that was my first ever. It cost me more to join the union than they paid me to do the film. In fact, my agent had to advance me the money so I could do this movie. And I had one line. It was with Michael J. Fox was in this movie. If you ever see it, there's a scene where he goes to disrupt a fashion show that Phoebe Cates is doing. And I'm standing behind a bar and I say, "I'm sorry, the bar is closed." And that was my first memorable line.
Did you practice saying that 1,000 different ways before doing it for real?
Well, for one thing, I was a nervous wreck. I mean, I had been a stage actor for many years. I'd been on Broadway and off-Broadway and gone all over the place. I'd never done a movie, and they don't know that, and they treat you as if you're an old pro, and they say, "Okay, now this is what's going to happen. He's going to come up. The camera's going to be here. You're going to hit your mark. You're going to do that." And you, of course, you say, "Yeah, right, I'll be there." And you're thinking, "What's a mark? What am I hitting? Who do I hit? Do I hit him? Who's Mark?" And it was very disturbing, but I got through that, and... no one was injured, so I think I did okay.
Okay, Crossing Delancey.
Oh.
Let me guess. You were the non-Jewish character.
I did once audition for a play in New York they did called Ashana Madel, and it was for a Jewish character, and I had to say the line, "You only love me for my mother's bagels." And I didn't believe me saying it, and so... They were very nice during the audition. No one asked me to leave or anything. But anyway, no, I was a non-Jewish character in Crossing Delancey. I love that movie, by the way. It's a sweet film. And what I most remember about it was I had to learn to play the cello. My character was a cellist. And there was a scene where Amy Irving, who's the lead in the movie, was having a birthday. And all of us who worked in this little bookstore with her were singing happy birthday to her. And I was playing it on the cello. And I literally, they paid for lessons. I learned how to play Happy Birthday on the cello. Amy Irving, who had done a movie called The Competition where she had to pretend to play the cello, made endless fun of me because, you know, I was squeaking it. But I finally got through the take and did it, and it was all perfect. And that scene segued into a scene on a phone from Florida where her parents' friends, who are a barbershop quartet, are finishing singing Happy Birthday over the phone. Well, when they put the film together... The guys singing the barbershop quartet were in a different key, so they dubbed the cello playing. So what I had slaved for weeks to learn, I'd never had to do in the first place. They were just going to lay it in anyway. So,
Tough luck.
It was hard.
Oh. Sleepless in Seattle.
That was my first connection with Seattle. And that, you know, of course, was a big hit movie. I had a very small part in it, but the funny thing is if you go back and watch it, the little scenes that I have, I play Meg Ryan's brother. I'm actually married. I'm in a very similar marriage to the one that Niles has with Maris. The actress who plays my wife is a little on the petite side, and she's kind of shrewish the way the character's written, and we have sort of a hate relationship, I think. But it was sort of foreshadowing of the rest of my life.
In Oliver Stone's movie Nixon, you played John Dean. Mm. What did you do to get in character?
Met with John Dean. Had several meetings with him did a lot of reading about John and the whole Watergate crisis and found out that depending on which book you read, John Dean was either a completely innocent victim of this whole thing or the evil mastermind behind the entire Watergate scenario, which was a little bit of a history lesson. And the other thing I did was watch the tapes of the hearings. And other than that, it was just the thrill of, you know, acting scenes with Anthony Hopkins.
What did you do with your voice for John Dean? It's such a familiar voice for people who remember the Watergate hearings.
Yeah, I didn't do a lot. There was a little bit of, I'm trying to think what it was. He's from California, and it wasn't that he had a particular accent. I think maybe some of the vowels were a little flatter than mine. Again, I didn't. None of us were trying to do exact imitations of the people. I mean, Anthony Hopkins is the most obvious example that when he did Nixon, he's completely capable of doing a spot-on Rich Little's quality Nixon impression. But he didn't want people to watch him do a Nixon impression because the most you get out of that is sitting there thinking, oh, he's really good doing a Nixon impression. So he kind of split the difference between hinting at Nixon's actual voice and certainly getting the physical mannerisms, but really making it more of a character performance for him. And to my taste, I think that was a really smart choice.
So I want to hear about other movies and stuff that you have coming up outside of Frasier.
I'm a voice in this new Disney Pixar movie, A Bug's Life, and that opens, I think it opens around Thanksgiving time.
What's the voice?
The voice is Slim, who's a walking stick bug. It's one of those bugs that's sort of tall and has a couple sets of hands and kind of bug-eyed, and I guess they're all bug-eyed, come to think of it, but he's particularly bug-eyed. It's got a great cast. Technologically, it's awe-inspiring. You just can't believe how beautiful it is. But that's not the point of the movie. It's a really good story, and it's very well told. And I did over the past hiatus, I was in Montreal shooting a movie which is a biography of Jacqueline Suzanne that stars Bette Midler as Jackie and Nathan Lane as her husband and manager, Irving Mansfield. And John Cleese is in it. Stockard Channing, Amanda Peet. It's a great cast, and it's a terrific script by Paul Rudnick, who wrote In and Out and Jeffrey and the Addams Family movies and stuff like that.
Well, David Hyde Pierce, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. I really want to thank you.
Well, thanks, Terry.
David Hyde Pierce plays Niles on Frasier. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Buck, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, screenwriter and director Todd Haynes talks about his new film, Velvet Goldmine, set in the glam rock era of the early 70s. And Ken Tucker reviews Sheryl Crow's latest CD, The Globe Sessions.
Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a piece. Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll feel your disease. There's nothing in my dreams, just some ugly memories. Kiss me like the ocean breeze. Hey!
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Velvet Goldmine is about the glam rock era of the early 70s when it became fashionable for male rock stars to create androgynous alter egos and dress theatrically in wild colors, feathers, and glitter. The characters in the film are inspired by such performers as David Bowie, Brian Ferry, Iggy Pop, and Lou Reed. My guest is the screenwriter and director Todd Haynes, whose previous films include Poison and Safe. The story of Velvet Goldmine is about a glam rock star named Brian Slade who fakes his own murder, then disappears. On the 10th anniversary of his disappearance, a reporter who used to be a big fan investigates the disappearance by interviewing people who used to work with Slade. Here's the reporter, played by Christian Bale, interviewing glam rock star Kurt Wilde, played by Ewan McGregor.
I was trying to contact you, actually, about a story I was doing about an old friend of yours. Brian Slade. I was trying to find out what actually happened to him.
Look.
I mean, before he became such a mystery.
Look, man, I don't know who you've been talking to or what you're after here, but...
What? What?
Listen. A real artist creates beautiful things and puts nothing of his own life into them, okay?
Is that what you did?
No. We set out to change the world. Ended up just changing ourselves.
I asked screenwriter and director Todd Haynes why he's interested in glam rock.
It's a pretty unique, as far as I see it, chapter in rock and roll history for a lot of reasons, I guess. It was this extremely flamboyant period where theatricality and costume and makeup and was being foregrounded, unlike anything that had preceded it. But it also very much woven into that were a whole series of ideas about gender and sexuality, and sort of a refusal for the artist to stand up there and speak from the gut to its his or her audience. It was more about dressing up into a variety of personas and constructing these ornate little narratives that, like Ziggy Stardust being probably the best known of those, through which to communicate these various ideas.
There's a scene in your movie, Velvet Goldmine, in which one of the characters is describing bisexuality and homosexuality as if they were styles or attitudes. You know, it's like just another costume to put on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that was the very much in opposition to 60s culture, which wore its political rhetoric very much, you know, on its sleeve. The glam ideas were given a much more fanciful, you know, lighter kind of approach. And yet I find them still to be extremely political, maybe inadvertently so, you know. And this kind of idea of sexuality as something that you could change, like your costume or your cosmetic style that for that day, is actually something I find pretty progressive in that it goes against, as all the glam sort of imagery does, goes against these very these natural models for identity and for sexuality, and instead suggests that, you know, it's for the it's sort of in the hands of the young person to decide who they are, to dress up and to try this and to try that. And I find that to be a pretty unique, another thing that sort of distinguishes it from other bits of rock and roll, which is so much about, usually about, like, authenticity and the sort of notion of who you really are, you know, that you got to find and stick to.
What did glam rock mean to you in its time?
In its time? Well, I guess, you know, it like I said, it was this invitation, sort of dangerous invitation into a series of transgressive positions in relationship to finding out who one is in the world, but done so in this very glossy, glittery, alluring, seductive manner, you know. So it became, I mean, I was a little bit too young for it, and particularly in America, where it really didn't have the same kind of commercial mainstream, you know, impact that it did in the UK. And when I first encountered those images of, you know, Bowie's face on the cover of Aladdin Sane in the record stores or whatever, at you know, at age 10 and 11, it was sort of too much for me. It's too dangerous, too forbidden in a way, but it still made a very deep impression.
Now, why did it seem dangerous to you?
I think it was this androgyny. I think it was this glamorous beauty on the face of a man, also in the guise of some sort of a space alien. You know, in a way, all these images were sort of thrust together in this interesting distillation of, you know, the pop icon as a sort of homosexual alien, you know, offering to take you somewhere completely new. And this image of David Bowie and Angela Bowie as the sort of bisexual couple of the future brought so many things into question, you know, about sexual stability, about monogamy, what is a relationship, what is a marriage. All of these ideas are sort of, you know, challenged in one image of this sort of, it must have seemed like the sort of space age futuristic, you know, world that was about to unfurl, that this would be the way we would all behave in the future, where sexual orientation and identity would no longer be stable.
Was it scary to you because it was forcing you to confront things that you weren't ready to think about yet?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was more comfortable with Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which, you know, included a lot of the themes that were found in glam rock in artists like Bowie's work and Roxy Music and Alice Cooper and stuff, artists like that. But it was a little bit easier. It was a little bit more of a mainstreaming of those themes.
Now, it's been reported that early on in the making of your movie, The Velvet Goldmine, you colored your hair and wore platform shoes, doing a little bit of the glam thing while you were directing the movie. And then you said you gave it up because it was just too high maintenance. It is really a lot of work to have
It's a lot of work, you know? I wasn't really doing it while we were shooting. It was really more in the writing stage.
Oh.
And I was very intrigued by this whole concept of kind of constructing oneself from the outside in, kind of changing oneself from the outside in that, you know, if you changed your hair and you started to wear different kind of clothes, some radical sort of sensibility would follow. And I saw that being played out not only in Bowie's quest to find the look that would finally work in the marketplace, but in Oscar Wilde as well, the way he constructed himself as a as Oscar Wilde, you know, one of the first celebrities of his era to do so with such sort of self-consciousness, I think. But it's funny for guys, you know, to wear super tight clothes and teetering on high heels with puffy hair that the wind sort of whistles through. You know, you feel this strange vulnerability, but also this funny kind of strength in it as well. This sort of like, you know, bitchy kind of conviction about who you are in the world that I guess women might feel when they're sort of made to feel vulnerable but attractive at the same time.
See, I think it's kind of subversive and liberating for a man perhaps to put on this mask of clothes and makeup and you know a new expressive hairdo and stuff. And I think it's often liberating for women to not do that.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
So many of us were brought up thinking that you had to do that just to survive in the world. You had to have, you know, high heels that you can't walk on and that hurt your feet and, you know, strapless gowns and just all these, you know, strange things that make it very hard to function.
Absolutely. So, but for men to feel attractive through vulnerability is such a different experience for most men. Mm-hmm, you know, that's just not what we're trained to feel ever, you know. So it was a funny, really an interesting little experiment. Didn't last too long, thankfully.
Oh, because you have a choice.
Yeah, it's true.
My guest is Todd Haynes. He wrote and directed the new film Velvet Goldmine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Todd Haynes is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Velvet Goldmine, which is about the glam rock movement of the early 70s. And he also wrote and directed Safe and Poison. Now, one of your kind of theories in The Velvet Goldmine is that The pop stars of the glam rock era are in their own ways, well, almost reincarnations of Oscar Wilde. You know, Kurt Wilde, one of the pop stars in your movie, says, "A man's life is his image," a kind of echo of the Oscar Wilde saying, which is also in your movie, "The first duty in life is to assume oppose what the second duty is. No one has yet found out." Mm. And then one of the characters says, "Give him a mask and he'll tell you the truth." Do you think that the glam rock people saw themselves as descendants of Oscar Wilde?
I'm not sure that the kids of the period and a lot of the more mainstream bands of the period were as sort of aware of a lot of the literary traditions that they were, that I see them following in, you know, in the footsteps of. But definitely Bowie, Brian Ferry, Brian Eno, this art school tradition that I was referring to earlier were, you know, sort of inundated by literary references, cinematic references, pop cultural references, and drew from all of this stuff in the creation of these looks and styles and the music that ensued. And so when I did my research, I sort of tried to retrace those steps and go back to the sources that were inspiring these artists. And in a way, try to find a cinematic, a visual equivalent or a narrative equivalent to what they were doing musically. And I couldn't not avoid Oscar Wilde. I mean, he just kept kind of coming up when you look at the ways in which they were sort of challenging natural models for the whole idea of performance, the whole idea of identity and sexuality. Oscar Wilde just became the obvious sort of precursor to that in a maybe the most articulate spokesperson for this tradition in England. And it's very English. It's a really English thing that I think as an American I was doubly curious about sort of trying to understand.
Your film made me think in part about the impact that glam rock must have had on a lot of sexually repressed or sexually confused teenagers who loved rock and roll and loved the music and saw this kind of great flamboyance and this great sexual flamboyance. Mm-hmm. And what impact all that must have had on the more repressed and confused fans. Did you find yourself thinking about that a lot?
I did. I felt that obviously the film is almost exclusively rooted in the point of view of the fan, who's played by Christian Bale. Plays Arthur Stewart in the movie, and how his memories of this period sort of meant everything to him. The period opened up possibilities that he never again in his life felt close to, and in fact the subsequent life he led was almost a repression, necessitated by this radical moment. And I, again, it wasn't my direct experience with glam rock, but I think there were other ways, other kinds of work coming out of this period, and probably films that I was seeing more in my life, that opened possibilities up to me, and that made me want to become a filmmaker. But what's really interesting about glam rock too is that it wasn't exclusive to, although it was mostly men up there on stage playing with, you know, a new kind of femininity in androgyny. Female audiences were incredibly riveted to it. And there wasn't a sort of logical identification. When David Bowie came out as bisexual, everyone was like, oh, you're going to lose your girl fans. And in fact, it only, you know, excited his audiences and they increased. And girls could enter into this sort of fantasy world of dressing up and of changing and of altering oneself just as easily as guys could. So it wasn't directly a gay interpretation or gay identification in a young boy that it was aimed at or that it worked on, which is curious to me. It's sort of how pop culture works in all these illogical ways too, which are pretty amazing.
You know, glam rock played with gender and sexual orientation, and yet I suspect that a lot of rock fans, at least ones in America, didn't really get all the sexual stuff that was maybe implied by it. Because I remember, like, when the news came out that David Bowie was bisexual and he'd slept with men, a lot of people were like, oh my God, he did? Like,
right.
Wow. And they were stunned, like, I'm shocked. And so it seems to me, if all of this was registering about, you know, sexual identity, that people wouldn't have been quite so surprised.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Or it works at all of these sort of, you know, sort of subconscious or intuited levels, I guess, where when it's literalized, you can't really deal with it, but it can function in all these suggestive ways, these visual cues. I mean, he was so camp on stage in that period, as were many of the other artists as well, Brian Ferry as well, who you don't really think of as playing with sexual roles to anywhere near the degree of Bowie, was just mincing around on stage at the beginning as well. It was sort of like de rigueur of this period. And I think it can. It's almost amazing how much that can be tolerated before you name it. And then when you name it, a lot of people, particularly in America, where things maybe are still in a more puritanistic, you know, literal context, or maybe more at that time, would freak out.
Some of the glam rock performers were bisexual, and I read a quote from you in which you said that you found bisexuality very interesting in that it's harder to define than homosexuality. It's a more slippery concept, and it implicates everyone in it. You have to look at your own sexuality in some way that might not be as comfortable as a willing acceptance of homosexuality over there.
Right.
Would you elaborate on that, why you find bisexuality more interesting in that respect?
I guess because it's not fixed. Again, I think we're most comfortable as a society with stable, concrete, you know, notions based on natural models of identity and sexuality as sort of these organic properties that you got to find and stick to. And bisexuality, which, you know, of course is part of the sort of whole Freudian, you know, thought, which defines all of us at the earliest stage as sort of polymorphously perverse, but then ultimately his theories, you know, have to take us to a place of getting normalized into a single sexual orientation, but there was something really risky and almost aggressive about bisexuality in this period. And I think it's as disquieting to gay people as it is to straight people. I think the whole liberation of the gay community has found great solace in this idea of being just as fixed and identified, you know, that you see the world completely through your sexual identity. That's who you are. You're a gay person, and there's something very stable and very comfortable about that, as comfortable and as stable as heterosexual models. But there becomes, at times, a sort of rigidity to that as well, where I have many gay friends now who have just inadvertently started relationships with women, gay men. And there's a sector of the gay community that's like, whoa, my God, that's so weird. You know, what's going on? You know, he's in denial. Or I think it's always great when sexuality surprises you and forces you to rethink the world, you know, and sort of sneaks up under our sort of safe ideas of who we are. And bisexuality is certainly that concept, I think, does that to both straights and gays.
Well, I think some people see bisexuals almost as tourists. You know, you can have a relationship with somebody of the same sex, but it doesn't mean you're really gay. You're just a tourist there. It's
exactly.
Not an authentic thing.
Right. But again, it's about based on authenticity and finding stability and sync, you know, staying in one place.
And that's supposed to be. And you're not interested in that kind of authenticity.
Well, I wish I was bisexual. I'm afraid I'm not. I'm bisexual in my mind, as I know, you know, certain people have said it before, and it always kind of bugs me when they say that. But it's true. I you know, I kind of wish I could be, but I'm not.
Why do you think you wish you could be, and why do you think you're not?
What do I wish I could be? I have wonderful women friends who I adore, you know, and I often think they're even more or maybe a lot more emotionally sophisticated in a lot of ways than men. And, you know, I would love to be able to engage, you know, intimately with that. But it's not where my desires take me, I guess, right now. But, you know, things change. We'll see what happens.
Todd Haynes wrote and directed the new film Velvet Goldmine. Here's a song written for the film called Ballad of Maxwell Demon. Maxwell Demon is the alter ego of the film's central character, Brian Slade.
Got tired of wasting gas, living above the planet. Quad 44, vicious metal hounds never come around here no more. Sometimes I wonder if I'm still alive. Six feet down at age 25. Maxwell Bell and Demon Rock and Jack. Came down that water 44.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Sheryl Crow's latest CD. This is Fresh Air. On her way to making her latest album, The Globe Sessions, Sheryl Crow has made a couple of standard new rock star moves. She's been linked in the tabloids with Eric Clapton, she's recorded a previously unreleased Bob Dylan track, and has put in a cameo in an indie film, the forthcoming The Minus Man, from the director of Bottle Rocket. But rock critic Ken Tucker says she sounds far from distracted on this third album.
Hey, let's party! Let's get down! Let's turn the radio on! This is Drag queens and the freaks are all out on town.
Coming off two solid hit albums, Sheryl Crow now offers music that pulls back from singer-songwriterly confessionalism. The Globe Sessions is a sustained yearning for privacy, solace, and escape, deriving from a fear that she might, as the title of one song has it, crash and burn. Produced by Crow and mixed by Chad Blake, the entire enterprise is filled with clatter and clutter. Guitar distortion, radio static, the sound of a phone left pulsing off the hook, that combine to convey a conflicted state of mind about love, fame, and the nagging feeling that she can't trust anyone's motives.
I am strong.
Wise enough to avoid self-pity, Sheryl Crow keeps her dissatisfactions vague on that song, Am I Getting Through? I'm scared that I'm weird, she says, and answers the title question of whether she's getting through with a muttered, I don't care, I don't care. When she wants to admit to insecurity, it's cast as an aside or a pun, as in Riverwide's watery refrain, Don't Bail on Me, which isn't to say that the Globe Sessions is unfocused or vague or not catchy. It leads off with the devilish single My Favorite Mistake, whose bouncy melody almost buries the fact that the title phrase is about a wayward, infuriating lover she can't quite dump. By the way, doesn't get enough credit for a wily sense of humor. There are lines in There Goes the Neighborhood, like the photo chick made to look sickly is standing in her panties in the shower, that are a perfect description of Fiona Apple's video for Criminal. There's an unlisted track tacked onto the end of the Globe Sessions that's a Bob Dylan-ly diatribe about the persecution of Bill Clinton. And is not the ragged, bluesy vocal on Crash and Burn a slurry, sly homage to Bonnie Raitt?
I watch the sun come.
packed my car and headed to LA. I gave away all my loose ends.
It's a measure of how good the Globe Sessions is that I couldn't pick out the outtake from Time Out of Mind that Bob Dylan gave her to record until I looked at the credits. And even then, Mississippi still sounds like just a nifty throwaway on an album of carefully crafted keepers.
Every step of the way, we walk the line. Your days are numbered, so are mine. Time is piling up, we struggle and we scrape. All boxed in, nowhere to escape. The city's just a jungle, more games to play. All trapped in the heart of it, trying to get away. I was raised in the country, been working in the town.
If you'd asked me in 1994, when Crow released her slow-to-click debut, Tuesday Night Music Club, whether she'd still be making music as vulnerable, rough and tumble, and irresistible by her third collection, I wouldn't have taken that bet. In cases like this, I'm always glad to be proven wrong.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tui Westman, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Little Brown & Company, publisher of The Thinker's Way, 8 Steps to a Richer Life by John Chaffee, Ph.D., in bookstores. And the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. This is NPR, National Public Radio.